The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on how vaccine teams may be coming to your home to give you your vaccine, whether you like it or not. The newest revolution in disinfecting hospital rooms, cleaning them up, something that I was sponsoring 20 years ago. Now it's in vogue. What if you have diabetes? What would that do to your brain? And supplements that are good for kidney disease? What meditation does for the quality of life? And your eyelids? What do they tell us? A lot. Inflammatory factors underlying most cancers, a special report from David Hufnagel of Life Extension. Two commentaries today. They're both brief, but no comment on these. Dennis Kucinich on the National Defense Appropriation Act and War Without End. And also Colonial Iraq, The Reality Behind the End of the Iraq War by Brian Becker. And then Robert Rodrigue Tremblay, who we just had on the program, The Official End of the Bush-Cheney Disaster in Iraq. No, it is not. And he'll tell you why. Those short commentaries. Our issue of the day, and this I am going to ask you to call in on, from Common Dreams, from John MacArthur, who is the publisher of Atlantic Monthly magazine. President Obama richly deserves to be dumped. Okay, who would take his place? Well, we'll share that, and I'm going to have some of these individuals on the air, including people that have phenomenally progressive agendas, and they're not allowed to debate. And these people have rich backgrounds in public health and in politics, so we'll give you some ideas. My guest for the second part of our program will be Bill McKibben, and we're going to talk about dirty oil money in politics, the XL pipeline, and talking about the failure of Durban, the environmental talks that led to nothing. So we're going to talk about all this, plus the release of methane gas plumes that I mentioned yesterday in massive amounts, coming now out of the melted ice in the Arctic, especially around Russia. And what does that mean? All bad things there, but we have to know about it so we at least can prepare. So that's our program. As you see, we are packed with 9 separate areas we will be focusing on, and each one is meant to empower us. Let's begin. As many of you know, we are trying to offer the best we can in the way of scholarly articles on challenging the safety and efficacy of vaccines. I've never told anyone, nor would I, that you should not take a vaccine or you should take a vaccine. What I am doing, and we have a whole team doing it, is we are researching the actual peer-reviewed scientific literature in immunology and in the vaccine sciences. And we're simply saying, for a given vaccine, whether it's the flu vaccine or whooping cough, or tetanus, or pertussis, can they prove that this vaccine will actually stimulate the immune system and antibodies that are protective? And if so, are there exclusions? Are there people that will not be protected? And are they safe? If not, what are the side effects or the actual effects? And what we're finding, all of which is contained in the articles, all of the articles are fully and heavily footnoted, all of which scientific peer-reviewed literature, their literature, is that we have been lied to and manipulated in one of the greatest public health frauds in history. Don't take my word for it. The articles, of which there are now 17, we just put one up. We've been averaging one per week, and we're putting hundreds of hours in per article. And then we're having an outside scientist review this for objectivity, accuracy. So we're putting it through an acid test. If nothing else, this should at least allow someone in public health a health reporter who is not completely co-opted within the mainstream media, to review what we've done. Instead of using the word cynic or skeptic or denialist, why don't you just read the articles and look at what they say? We have been lied to. We have been manipulated. Millions have been hurt, hundreds of thousands killed by a public health policy that does nothing more than benefit the vaccine manufacturers, the lobbyists that they hire, and the politicians they buy. The scientists who are on their payroll and the physicians who benefit. It is just one giant fraud. We need to finally address it. We have produced two major award-winning documentaries, Vaccine Nation and Autism Made in the USA. We have produced over 17 major articles. I'm now working, in fact today, we'll be filming in mid-Canada our third documentary just on the science. The only people in this documentary are immunologists and vaccine scientists. And I'm challenging them, politely but challenging them, show me the evidence. If you're going to put 16 vaccines into an under one-year-old child, show me where that is going to stimulate the antibodies. They can't, and they acknowledge that. Then why are you allowing it to be done? Why aren't you speaking up? I have whistleblowers. I have professors. That'll be coming out sometime in the late spring. Now, that's on one side of the ledger. And if you go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, you'll see over 345 separate films that I have produced, which are there. Segments, interviews. In fact, I'm so concerned about this information that I'm taking Harvard physician Dr. Nancy Banks and George Washington University physicians and other major physicians, this week all three women, and putting their full interviews up on our YouTube site so you can see for yourself. They're unedited, meaning I just took the whole strip, because in the final documentary, out of a two-hour interview, maybe 3 minutes from each one, because I have 40 people in a film, plus B-roll, plus the personal testimonials and everything else I have to put in a film. I didn't want to leave this great information out, so you can watch what Dr. Nancy Banks and Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and the others have to say. And that way it'll give you a real education. And as you can see, there's no editing. It's just straight comments. And it's there, and I'm doing that with all of it. In fact, for those of you who doubt the idea that AIDS is caused by a single virus, why don't you take a look at what the Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Kerry Mullis, has. In the first time I've shown it, the full unedited interview of Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the PCR, polymerase chain reaction, which is one of the scientific techniques used in all of AIDS science. And watch what he has to say. Listen to what he has to say in the interview at his beach home in California. 18 minutes. Powerful information. This is the type of information, when you have a man of this credibility, with this many scientific articles, with this many inventions, with this Nobel Prize, with a professorship, surely someone in the mainstream media should have said, shouldn't we pay attention to what he's saying? Nobody has touched what he is saying. When we've advocated that he debate others like Robert Gallo, they won't debate him because he would tear their arguments to shreds and the people would see it. So they stay away from him. It's like he doesn't exist. But he's not alone. There are other Nobel Prize winners in science who agree with him. And we have them all. Go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. You have 2,300 individual scientists, physicians, and activists, including gay activists and scientists, who say everything we've been told about the war on AIDS is wrong. No one's denying AIDS diseases. Absolutely, they exist. No one's denying that we can help these individuals. We have, and we have proof. But they've done it all wrong. These are the same people that would be leading the war on drugs. And you know what kind of disaster that's been. Now they're just leading war on AIDS. So it's time that we realize we have resources available to educate us, to inform us, to empower us. Now, this is from Jeffrey John Afferdhide. Congressional shenanigans, vaccine teams coming to your home and vaccinating your child. I'll quote. Just imagine this. Health officials coming to your house and force vaccinating your children. It seems a bit outrageous initially, but put into context, this is a small potato compared with U.S. Congress recently passing the National Defense Authorization Act. I'll show you later how public health and school officials will probably make up the bulk of this task force. If you want to know more and what you can do about it, then read on. You may recall recently that school officials in Nanaimo, California, were going door to door searching for unvaccinated children. School officials attempted to vaccinate children, mostly homeschooled children, with a whooping cough vaccine. Parents were infuriated and used some language when slamming doors in their faces. During a recent newscast, Hyman Matlock, a public education servant, is seen attempting to intimidate a mother by stating, quote, "Okay, we're coming today to give her a DBT, and if she hasn't had it, done yet." However, there's a dirty little secret involved. That little secret is, who is funding that operation? It is likely buried in over 2,000 pages of congressional red tape. Parents who do not vaccinate their children can expect similar goons knocking on their doors. Let me explain. On Christmas Eve 2009, the Senate passed H.R. 3590. The bill eventually became Public Law No. 111-148, which gives the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, authorization to create, quote, vaccination squads, unquote, in local communities to seek out unvaccinated children to, quote, vaccine squads are called the Community Preventative Service Task Force. Not only will the task force be working with the CDC's advisory committee on immunization practices, as Cindy Loveland notes in an article, but on page 1202 of that law, the most relevant responsibilities are listed, quote, carrying out immunization-promoting strategies for participants or clients of public programs, including assessment of immunization status, referrals to health care providers, education provision, on-site immunizations and incentives for immunization. Provide for home visits to promote immunization through education, assessment of need, referrals, and other services. Provide reminders, conduct assessments, and any combination or more of interventions described. Unquote. Now, these aggressive measures are the fruits of pharmaceutical industry lobbying, of ALEC, and influence. I can only imagine police or sheriffs escorting the vaccine squads for non-compliant parents. This should be of great concern to parents. To understand how things become a reality, you have to understand the money talks. Just check out how Big Pharma contributes to congressional members' campaign bank accounts. But the bigger question is this: who's in charge? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says, quote, "It's good to be king." The most troubling aspect of Public Law 111-148 is it puts the director of the CDC in the driver's seat for creating the task force. Page 1126 admits, quote, Section 399U, Community Preventative Services Task Force, establishment purpose, the director of the CDC and prevention shall convene an independent Community Prevention Services Task Force to be composed of individuals with appropriate expertise. Unquote. Why should this be a concern? The concern is that pharmaceutical companies own, control public health officials, literally. A blatant example is explained by health expert Robert Scott Bell, writing about former head of the CDC, Julia Gerberding. Quote, "The most recent in a long list of government bureaucrats to leave the public dole and take up the high-paying cause of Big Pharma is none other than the former head of the CDC, Julia Gerberding. 1 year and 1 day from the date of departure from the taxpayer payroll, she takes the reins as president of the vaccine division of the principal descendant of IG Farben, Merck Pharmaceuticals." So, heads up on that happening. Now, the good news. There was a time when we were doing a series of experiments on how to purify blood. This is back around 1990. And what we were finding was ozone could do that. In fact, it was called autohemotherapy. You would take the blood out and it would be dark. And then you would put ozone in it and it would turn bright red. And then you put back that in, put that blood, highly oxygenated blood back into the patient, and they would just have such a boost in energy. But then you could do a viral kill-off. we would have 20 persons with AIDS-defining illnesses in a room at a time. They would all have their viral titers done, their viral load, and measuring different types of viruses. Then you would give them the oxygenated ozone blood, and then about 3 hours later, you would see a massive kill-off and of the viruses. And so it went as far as I was just about to do a major experiment in Zimbabwe, because we had the top physician in Zimbabwe and a group of five physicians at a hospital who agreed to work with 1,000 persons diagnosed with full-blown AIDS. I was going to fund the whole project. It would be free to the patients, and we would have 1,000 individuals given the standard World Health Organization anti-AIDS retroviral cocktails, and then we would have 1,000 individuals given a health-supporting diet, clean water, and oxygenated blood, and a hyperbaric chamber. And 2 weeks before all this was to start, that's when hyperinflation occurred and it became prohibitively expensive. I simply couldn't afford it. And then political chaos ensued, and we were going to do this at the university there. In any case, it never got done, but we had done small research in the United States. Here's the latest. This is from Queen's University. It says, quote, from Science Daily, by the way, this is mainstream science. New disinfection technique could revolutionize hospital room cleansing. A Queen's University infectious disease expert has collaborated in the development of a disinfection system that may change the way hospital rooms all over the world are cleaned, as well as stop bed bug outbreaks in hotels and apartments. Quote, this is the future because many hospital deaths are preventable with better cleaning methods. And it has been reported that more than 100,000 people die in North American hospitals every year due to infections acquired within that, and at a cost of $30 billion. Dr. Zaltman also used this disinfection technology to kill bed bugs. A major U.S. hotel chain has already expressed interest in the technology. What is the technology? Metazone, specific ozone and hydrogen peroxide vapor gas, the very things we were using. Well, now they're doing it, and good for them. I don't know if any of our early work they were aware of. I wrote some articles. But if not, I'm glad to see this is going forward. And this should be used because you can also use ozone to autoclave, meaning sterilize at above 700 degrees, instruments in dentist's office and physician's office and hospitals, and that would prevent infections from spreading. And you could do this over all surface areas. This was published in the American Journal of Infectious Control. So that's good news. Now, what happens when you've got diabetes? A really negative side effects that you could deal with: memory loss, depression. These are all types of cognitive impairments. They're serious consequences of diabetes. And neurophysiologist Dr. Vera Novak of Beth Israel Medical Center in Boston and colleagues reported that older patients with diabetes end up having more inflammation in the brain, and that in turn triggers a series of events that affect the blood vessels and eventually cause brain injury and atrophy, which reduces cognition. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care. Now, my suggestion, give them known anti-inflammatory nutrients. There are many and easy to use. Easy, such as curcumin at 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams and green tea at 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams and quercetin at 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams and vitamin C. All of these turn off inflammation, including in the brain, and then give them something like glycerophosphatidylcholine, which can help stimulate a healthier brain. And finally, what supplements are good for the kidneys? According to the American Society of Nephrology, pomegranate juice. Quote, pomegranate juice lowers kidney disease patients' cholesterol, blood pressure, and the need for blood pressure medications. So that's good. And also cherry juice. In fact, they tried a cherry juice versus a placebo for 7 days, and urine samples were collected from all the participants before and during the investigation, and they found that melatonin, which is a natural compound within the cherry juice, helped influence the sleep-wake cycles in a positive way. So cherry juice is great, and pomegranate juice is also great. And this was published in the journal, European Journal of Nutrition. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Doing an in-depth investigative report on the smart meters and what they actually do, what you're not told they'll do, and why this is just, A, they're very bad for your health, emitting radiation, electromagnetic pulses, but also how they can literally monitor everything going on in your house and why this wasn't explained to people. That'll be on an upcoming program. A few comments from individuals who I did not have a chance to present their information last evening on my Progressive Commentary Hour on an in-depth discussion on the Iraq, the true meaning of our being in Iraq. So I wanted to add these few. They're short. This is from Brian Becker and Colonial Iraq, the reality behind the so-called end of the Iraq war. Our war there will be over. All of our troops will be out of Iraq, President Obama said December 17th. But while combat troops are leaving, for now at least, the U.S. government is creating a staff of 16,000 for its newly constructed embassy in the heart of Baghdad. Although Iraq has only 28 million people, the new U.S. embassy is the largest in the world. It is a massive compound that is one and a half square miles, an enormous complex of 22 buildings, the size of 94 football fields. Half of the 16,000 personnel staff will consist of a private military army made up of mercenaries under the control of the Secretary of State. The State Department budget is estimated at $30 billion for the next 5 years. In addition, the Pentagon retains a vast network of bases, sea, and air power surrounding Iraq. Washington's intention clearly is to dominate Iraq for the many years to come in a colonial-type relationship. Iraq possesses the second-largest oil reserves in the world. Obama's speech was the latest in a series of appearances seeking to bolster the president's re-election prospects by associating himself with the end of the war in Iraq. The dishonesty of this presentation would be considered breathtaking, except for the fact that his deception fits exactly into the patterns of lies and deceit practiced by all other Democrats and Republicans who have served as the CEO of the U.S. imperial state. While trying to ingratiate himself with the service members, veterans, and their families, Obama vastly underestimated the real damage done to them, stating that, quote, tens of thousands have been wounded. The official Pentagon figure of U.S. wounded is 32,000, but a Brown University study this year reported that 1.25 million service members who have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan at that time, nearly half have filed disability claims. In other words, 600,000 a big majority Iraq veterans. Nor did the president mention that many thousands of returning vets are now homeless, living in the streets, a number that grows daily. And by the way, sitting in the studio, and I'll go to him in a moment, is Richard Polonesky, one of our executive producers. Richard is finishing editing my newest film, and the full feature documentary will be out in about a month, but I'm showing you 45 to 50 minutes of it tomorrow, only of homeless vets. How many? 16,000 living in just one area of Florida alone in the woods. You'd never know they're there. But I was invited, I was the only journalist invited, to their stand down about 4 weeks ago, where they get food and clothing and sleeping bags from donations from other vets. And all the people working there that day were vets. It was a heart-rending story to film. I want to tell you, if you saw my cameraman, he had tears in his eyes through most of this. It was just heart-wrenching, and yet this story is untold. Well, it will be told, and you will see it tomorrow, at least one big part of it. And these are the people that Obama has never once mentioned. No one mentions them. And I ask these people, where's Sean Hannity? Where's Glenn Beck? Where's Geraldo when it comes to seeing what happens to you when you return? Are you still considered heroic upon your return? No. They've never seen these people. Also, no mention either that the war in Iraq has already cost more than $1 trillion and will likely end up costing about $6 trillion. But the most glaring omission was the catastrophic impact of the war on Iraq and its people. Quote, for nearly 9 years, our nation has been at war in Iraq, said Obama. In reality, the war in Iraq has been going on for more than 20 years. The 1991 Desert Storm destruction of the country's infrastructure and the lethal 13-year sanction blockades preceded the 2003 invasion. How many people died? 500,000 children. Isn't it amazing we cannot acknowledge when our actions caused the death of 500,000 children? More than 2 million Iraqis have died as a result of the war and sanctions. 4.5 million have been displaced, and an unknown number, but one which must be counted in the millions, are wounded. There are over 1 million widows in Iraq, all this in a country of just 28 million people. The U.S. occupiers disbanded the entire government and shut down all vital service systems such as health care and food distribution. The occupation deliberately pitted religious and ethnic groups against each other using the classic method of colonial divide and rule. This policy greatly exacerbated sectarian violence that took a toll in the hundreds of thousands and continues to plague Iraq today. A once relatively stable society was ripped to shreds. There's not a single reference in the president's proclamation about the horrific crimes committed against Iraq. Just colonial-style statements like, quote, Iraq's future will be in the hands of its own people, unquote, as if the U.S. occupation had, instead of inflicting untold destruction, been a training session for the Iraq people in self-government. Iraq had been an independent country for 45 years after kicking out the British colonizers in 1958 as one of the most economically and socially advanced countries in the Arab world prior to the 1991 war, despite having the terrible influence of Saddam Hussein. Despite all that they have suffered, the Iraq people have a long and proud history of struggle against imperialism and injustice. Now, finally, from Roderick Tremblay, professor. He says the Obama administration officially put an end to the Iraq war on December 15th. I had not intended to comment on the end of this most unnecessary war, but since I wrote a book to explain how it all came about, I feel that I must say something. Analysts have begun to describe this war launched on false pretenses as, quote, the biggest mistake in American military history. Indeed, beginning right after 9/11 and throughout 2002, the Bush-Cheney administration had its mind firmly set to invade Iraq military. And no fact, law, or argument could deter it from doing so, in that it was following the blueprint that neocons and pro-Israel Likudniks under the leadership of Paul Wolfowitz, Bush's future Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Louis Scooter Libby, Cheney's future Chief of Staff, had drafted in 2000 under the auspices of the Project for the New American Century in a report entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. This was a neoconservative imperial project that began officially the Bush Doctrine. Its goal was to project, as far as possible in the future, the, quote, unipolar advantageous position that the United States inherited after the breakup of the Soviet Union, 1991. It was really a hubristic and bare-knuckle strategy for world power, based upon unilateral interventionism militarily, economically, and politically by the U.S. It was, quote, an American-first doctrine based not upon modern international law, but rather on an approach to the American interest and the elementary principle of brute force. In fact, it was a giant step backward that could have consequences for decades to come. In conclusion, in the book that I wrote in 2003 to denounce such a suicidal shift in American foreign policy, I pointed out that the Bush Doctrine was a near identical reenactment of the infamous 1968 Soviet Union's Brezhnev Doctrine, which paved the way for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. Ultimately, it also led to the demise of the Soviet Union. Contrary to what some think, the war against Iraq did not arise from a generous desire to promote democracy around the world. In fact, spreading democracy was little more than a domestic war propaganda slogan. End quote. Just two comments I thought were important. Now, in just a few moments, we're going to go to my guest, Bill McKibben, who's here. I just want to share this one issue of the day. And then you have a chance to call in, and at the end of the program, we will come to you. This is from John R. MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine. Quote, President Obama richly deserves to be dumped. As evidence of a failed Obama presidency accumulates, criticism of his administration is mounting from liberal Democrats who have too much moral authority to be ignored. Most prominent among these critics is veteran journalist Bill Moyers, whose October address to a public citizen gathering puts the lie to our barely Democratic president's populist pantomime, acted out last week in a Kansas speech decrying the plight of, quote, innocent, hardworking Americans. In his talk, Moyers quoted an authentic Kansas populist, Mary Elizabeth Lease, who in 1890 declared, quote, Wall Street owns the country, money rules. The political parties lie to us and the political speakers mislead us, unquote. A former aide to Lyndon Johnson, who knows politics from the inside, Bill Moyers then delivered the coup de grace. Quote, Lee, should you see us now, John Boehner calls on the bankers, hold out his cup and offers them total obedience from the House majority if only they fill it. Barack Obama criticizes bankers as fat cats and invites them to dine at a pricey New York restaurant where the tasting menu runs to $195 a person. As it happens, Moyer's remarks anticipated the question posed in an interview by another prominent liberal, Barbara Ehrenreich, just after billionaire Michael Bloomberg and mayors of other cities cleared public spaces of Occupy Wall Street protesters. Quote from Barbara Ehrenreich, where in all this was Obama? Why couldn't he have picked up the phone and called the mayors of Portland and Oakland and said, go easy on these people. They represent the angry aspirations of the majority. Would that have been so difficult? End quote. Well, yes, particularly if your principal occupation is shaking down bankers and brokers for campaign donations on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. By now, it should be obvious that the system, the Democratic Party, run by Obama, not the other way around, under his arrangement, the president carries out his duties as preeminent party functionary, fundraising being at the top of his list of responsibilities, and defers on legislation. Leave it to the corrupt Democratic barons, such as Senator Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, devoted friend of the insurance, pharmaceutical, and banking crowd, and sworn enemy of the reform. And as Ron Suskin's book, Confidence Men, confirms, there was never any question doing things differently. Describing the then-president-elect's choice of economic advisors, he notes, quote, Obama, after all, had selected for his top domestic officials two men, Lawrence Summers and Timothy Geithner, whose actions in Clinton administration had contributed to the very financial disaster they were hired to solve. These anti-reform opponents did not go unnoticed by party regulars, even though they were ignored by Obama groupies. Quote, I don't understand how you could do this. Suskind quotes Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, saying to Obama, you've picked the wrong people. The wrong people included Rahm Emanuel, now mayor of Chicago, and his replacement as White House Chief of Staff William Daley. Both of these advisors were four-star generals within the Chicago Democratic machine who cut their teeth in Washington during the campaign to pass that job killer NAFTA, the North American Trade Act, and who later worked for investment banks. But Obama hypocrisy in Kansas set a new standard in deception. Among other things, his speech blamed, quote, regulators who were supposed to warn us about the dangers of all this, but looked the other way or didn't have the authority to look at all. It was wrong. It combined the breathtaking greed of a few with irresponsibility all across the system, unquote. What's truly breathtaking is the president's gall, his stunning contempt for political history and contemporary reality. Besides neglecting to mention Democratic complicity in the debacle of 2008, he failed to point out that derivatives trading remains largely unregulated, while the Securities and Exchange Commission awaits public comment on detailed implementation plan for future regulation. In other words, until the banking and brokerage lobbies have had their say with John Boehner, Mac Baucus, and Secretary of Treasury Tim Geithner. Meanwhile, the administration steadfastly opposes restoration of the Glass-Steagall Act, the New Deal law that reduced outlandish speculation by separating commercial and investment banks. In 1999, it was Timothy Geithner and Summers, led by Bill Clinton's Secretary of Treasury Robert Rubin, who was admired by Obama, who persuaded Congress to repeal this crucial impediment to Wall Street recklessness. And then there's Afghanistan. Obama should be condemned for escalating this grotesquely expensive, destructive, and self-defeating war. Thoroughly discredited by analysts on both sides of the left and the right, the Afghan madness seems to bore liberals who once would have marched against Vietnam. I suggest they watch the brilliant new documentary, Hell and Back Again, to enhance their knowledge of the war's casualties. The pitiful story of Marine Sergeant Nathan Harris ought to make them furious at our commander-in-chief. Shouldn't it also spark an inter-party revolt? I urge people who haven't given up on politics to examine the career of Allard Lowenstein. Lowenstein founded the Dump Johnson movement in 1967 and against all odds persuaded Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota to launch a Democratic primary challenge against the incumbent president over the issue of Vietnam. His example, I hope, might inspire someone to challenge another Democratic incumbent who has forfeited the trust of the people. And that's from John MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine. Isn't it time that the Democrats and the liberals who support that movement start to look around for people who truly are populist, anti-war, anti the corruption and greed, and pro-reform, and I mean strict reform of banking, and stop the subsidies to the major corporations, get out of foreign policy issues of militarization around the world, could help us all, and become pro-environment, something this president and all the other presidents are completely against. I'm Gary Nall. Your comments, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I will take some of your calls before the end of the program. Let's immediately go over and say hello to my guest, Bill McKibben, standing by. Bill's one of the nation's best-known environmental activists and authors whose book, The End of Nature, way back in 1989, first alerted the American public to global warming. And since then, he's become one of the nation's leading environmental activists, opposing fossil fuel excesses, mountain clearing of coal, the natural gas industry, and other greenhouse gas technologies, increasing the pace of global warming. He is the creator of the 350 organizational movement, and he is here also, his book, Earth, spelled with two A's, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Nice to have you with us today, Bill.
Well, as always, good to be with you, brother.
Bill, let's take a look at your efforts, the efforts of thousands of people to stop that pipeline, the XL pipeline going from Canada to Texas, and how this administration, this Congress, including the President and Democrats, who should have been at the forefront of protecting the environment and honoring this science that shows what can happen when you run a pipeline through all of this part of America, how they turned around and betrayed you and betrayed the movement and what we have to know about this.
Well, this is one of these interesting stories. 6 months ago, really nobody had heard of this pipeline outside of Nebraska and a couple of other places where it was going to go through. And then, because it has such huge global warming implications, the tar sands of Canada, where it's coming from, are the second largest pool of carbon on Earth. We asked people if they would come to Washington and protest. And in August, 1,253 of us were arrested over 2 weeks in front of the White House. It was the biggest civil disobedience action in about 30 years in this country. And it started the process of bringing this project to public attention. And we continued all fall, sort of bird-dogging President Obama wherever he went, and, you know, college kids would all be chanting, "Yes, we can, stop the pipeline," and it was pretty good, and it got better on early November when we came back to the White House, this time completely legally, and managed to circle it with people five deep around the White House. It was a gorgeous day, and everybody's signs were just quotes from President Obama in 2008 about how he was going to take action on climate change. To his credit, 4 days later, President Obama announced that this pipeline was going to go back for a much more thorough review. It was going to take a year or a year and a half, and would look at things including climate. It wasn't any kind of permanent victory. There are very few permanent victories in the environmental business. But it was, a done deal had come undone. TransCanada had mowed the 1,700-mile route of this pipeline just the week before. That's how confident they were going to be laying pipe before the year was out. So it was a good thing. Of course, doing it angered the heck out of big oil, and they're doing their best right now on Capitol Hill to take their revenge. One of the reasons we're not getting at the moment a payroll tax cut for middle-income Americans is because the GOP is demanding that the pipeline be put back in business, that it be fast-tracked and approved in a matter of weeks before anybody can do any kind of environmental analysis. It's a complete and utter scam. I mean, it's, you know, they took a vote in the House the other day, and it went mostly on party lines, with most of the Republicans voting in favor of this pipeline and most of the Democrats voting against. But the more interesting breakdown was just, you know, big oil versus not. The 234 representatives in the House who voted for the pipeline had taken a total of $42 million in dirty energy money for their campaigns. The 200 people who voted against had taken something like $5 million. It couldn't have been much starker. This is just big energy using its bought and paid for fleet of congressmen to get its job done in the dark that it can't get done in the open. And it's been incredibly instructive for me to watch, and what it demonstrates is the just corrosive power of that money. Now, I must say, in the last week or so, President Obama has been doing very much the right thing. He said if they demand this quick review of the pipeline, then he will deny the permit for the pipeline. His administration has said it over and over again. Couldn't be much more clear. And that's a somewhat courageous thing to be doing, because he knows that big oil will spend tens of millions of dollars running campaign ads full of lies about how he's killing jobs or destroying energy security or something else by doing it. So he's been, I got to say, more stand-up on this than one might have guessed. In part, it may be because his campaign hasn't been taking money directly from corporations. But, boy, the guys who have, I mean, they might as well just put an Exxon sign out in front of the Capitol and, you know, install a couple of pumps and a grubby bathroom and a kind of microwave burrito station and turn it into the gas station that it is. It's disgusting what they do up there.
But, Bill, please, I'm sure you're aware that Obama has made dozens of promises and has broken them all, including that he would veto the Military Authorization Act. Just absolutely signed it. It's now law.
I spent 3 days in jail this year for sitting in outside Obama's White House, you know. I'm not soft on the guy. I'm just telling you, in this case, he's doing what he says he does, and you've got to give people credit for the things they do right as well as call them out on the things they do wrong, I think.
But I have to distinguish what he does right because it's politically convenient. That's why I read these articles earlier about what we're really doing by getting out of Iraq. We're not really getting out of Iraq. We've transferred soldiers out but then brought in mercenaries equal to their number and will still continue to contribute $30 billion to the largest embassy in the world.
No argument. The only thing I was talking about is this one isolated pipeline. And, you know, okay. Obama's done a lot of things that aren't useful on climate change. He opened up a big swath of Wyoming to coal mining. He opened up the Arctic to new drilling. He vetoed these ozone rules earlier this year. He's done a couple of things that'll be useful. He took the auto companies and worked out a deal where they're going to dramatically increase automobile mileage over the next 15 years. Now, I think that was a kind of indicative one because it didn't require standing up to angry companies. We basically owned the auto industry after we bailed them out. The Keystone thing may be a little more significant if he actually follows through.
Let's put pressure on him.
Oh,
but remember, one of the reasons that he had to increase the mileage per gallon was because the Japanese and the Chinese and the Indians already have cars that will be getting 60 miles to a gallon
in
the next 5 years.
I've been driving a 50 mile gallon car for a decade, so it's not like it's a huge leap, but given the set of choices on offer in Washington, all I'm telling you is that on this issue, he's been better than the alternative. I mean, look, Newt Gingrich got up the other night and claimed that the only reason anyone would oppose the Keystone Pipeline was to appease San Francisco environmentalists, whatever that means. I don't know if they're still thinking San Francisco and gay people and something like that. I don't know what they're thinking. I don't think they really are thinking. I think that they have, you know, absolutely no backbone at all. I'm pretty sure that if the Koch brothers told Mitt Romney to frack Old Faithful so that it blew gas instead of water, he'd ask him how high he wanted it to go, you know. I think the basic job is not about personalities at this point, though. I think the basic job is about trying to figure out how the hell to get money out of politics. We're going to have a big battle campaign next year at 350.org to try and remove the subsidies from the fossil fuel industry, because it's absurd that we pay them hundreds of billions of dollars.
Over $300 billion this year. $300 billion.
And this is, A, ludicrous because they're destroying the planet.
But they're also the most profitable corporations in the world.
B, because they're making money hand over fist. C, because you would theoretically give subsidies to help people start some enterprise that, you know, was difficult. We've known how to burn black rocks to make energy for 300 years. And four, I mean, the really ludicrous thing is that the biggest subsidy that these guys get isn't even in the form of money. It's that we allow them to be the only business on Earth that's allowed to just pour their waste product into the atmosphere for free. You know, they get to pour their car. They get to use the atmosphere as an open sewer for free in which to dump all that carbon. I mean, think about what that means. Try to think of some analogy. Like, let's say you have a restaurant in town, and your restaurant is granted permission to just shovel your garbage out into the middle of the street every night at the close of business. Now, you can charge less money than the guys next to you because they're having to treat their waste responsibly, and therefore you get more business. That's why the fossil fuel industry does better than the solar industry or whatever at the moment, because they have the sweetheart deal of all time, and they'll do anything to keep it, including, most importantly, maintaining this ready fleet of congressmen and senators to do their bidding. So it is disgusting, and we are doing everything we can to try and figure out how to bring it down. I think one of the problems is, Gary, oddly, that we've gotten so used to it that at some level we're no longer shocked by it. We kind of expect it. And that's, on the one hand, understandable, and on the other hand, I think it weakens us. I think we have to be able to rekindle some of that correct and simple outrage at the fact that people are, in essence, selling our public policy. To me, the analogy is, I mean, imagine if you went to the you know, if you were watching the Super Bowl in January and, you know, outruns the owner of the Patriots or something before the middle of the game, and right there in the middle of the field, he hands each referee $10,000, you know, and then runs off the field. How, you know, how outraged would everybody be? Well, that's exactly what goes on in our political system, and we've got to make it stop. We've got to
wrap that around
those guys' necks.
We need new politicians who are truly populist, truly progressive, and cannot be bought, who will insist upon new laws that gets money out of politics. If we can't get money out of politics, and nothing changes. Bill, we're out of time, but do this. Give us your website so we can support your efforts.
350.org. It's the big grassroots international climate campaign, and we would love people's help.
And you know, one last parting thought here. You spend time in jail. A lot of other people, Chris Hedges, our friend, spent time in jail.
Yes.
What if outside the White House one day, protesting the gas line, the oil line, were three people: Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, and Malcolm X. You got a Nobel Prize winner there, and you got two peace activists. Wonder if the president would say, "Go ahead and throw him in jail," or would he come out and have a conversation with him?
Let's hope that he'd come out and have a conversation.
He didn't have a conversation with you.
He didn't have a conversation with us when we were out there.
But let's see if something can shake this man's consciousness away from the imperial presidency and just the glory of being president.
I'm afraid some of us may have to go to jail again. And we'll look forward to seeing you there with us as always.
Always, I'll be there. Thank you
very
much, Bill McGibbon. Bill McKibben, my guest. I'm Gary Null. Please go to the website to support all that they're doing, 350.org, 350.org. Now, into our studio in New York City, and we have, and I am now going to take calls, so you weren't calling. Now you can call in about your thoughts on finding a progressive new party, and I'm going to have some progressives on the air. I'm going to have progressives who are libertarian, independent, Democrat, Republican, who you haven't heard of. These are legitimate people, but they're not allowed on the forum because what they have to say would just shake people. They are so radically different in how they're looking at solutions. And we will have a forum for them, so at least you know how many other good minds are there. That'll be a whole hour next week. Now we're going in, and we're going to take some calls at 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Richard Polineski in our studio. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. You're going to have that homeless vet segment, part two, ready for tomorrow?
The actual film should be completed at some point, hopefully tomorrow. But I think for the general public, Thursday is probably a safer bet for them to be able to see it.
Okay. And it'll be up on Gary and all YouTube films, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Good. Okay. Also, Richard, we're looking for senior citizens who are financially struggling, retirees who may not be senior citizens, who are financially struggling, and parents with children who are struggling. Richard is in final editing for a spring release of our major film, possibly the most important film that we've done on Poverty, Inc. If you are in any of those categories, please call Richard directly so we can film your story. Come to your home. Richard, give your number, please.
Absolutely. It's 646-926-5422. 646-926-5422.
Thank you. And again, we're looking for some people to film in that area. We have about 600 hours of filming. We've done more filming and traveling on this than any other documentary ever. I've been working on it for years. I'm going to go to your calls in a few moments, but let's go into studio and say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hi. We have some questions here from the audience, but they're quite long answers, so I just wanted to mention to you today that there's news that Keith Olbermann, his show on Current, is actually has extremely low ratings. On average, about 30,000 people per night are watching him. But as we understand, he has an enormous publicity campaign, and he was right at the top on MSNBC. The question is, why are people not watching him?
I can't answer that. I would only give a projection. When Keith Olbermann was challenging the Republicans and Obama and George Bush, his ratings were the highest on, except for Fox, and he was the highest on MSNBC, and he did some brilliant, laudatory commentaries. In my opinion, the best of anyone on television. And when he went over to Current TV, and they do good work on Current TV, they have some outstanding documentaries, especially their Vanguard series. They put a lot of money behind that. But now almost every one of his shows is the same. Long amounts on Occupy Wall Street. It's a very narrowly defined discussion he has. My suggestion for Oberman would be to expand and be as critical of corruption, of the Democrat-Republican process, because the story gets more and more narrow. And so if you heard one, you hear them all. If you see one person, the same people back over and over and over again. And I just believe that it doesn't have the vitality or the originality that it once had. He is certainly a very intelligent person. He has the capability of doing that. But at the end of the day, if you do not empower your audience, if you don't give them the insights, they will leave you. And that's why I believe his audience has shrunk. But that's my own opinion. I'd like to see him get stronger. He has certainly got one of the best brains out there, and he does outstanding commentaries, but he has brought on Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank and people who are part of the problem, not the solution, and he's very disdainful of Ron Paul. He has been deeply critical of anyone in the Tea Party movement without looking at what he could find that would be of value. I mean, I'm critical of Ron Paul. He has a lot of things I'm opposed to. But he also has things that are very important. And given if anyone's going to change anything, wouldn't it make sense to find someone who will change the things that are most important that could help people immediately? He's not looking at any of that. It's either black or white. And I believe that that has cost him a lot of his progressive audience.
Right. Thank you.
We have time for one more, and then we'll be saying goodbye to our one-hour stations, but we'll be continuing on to take some calls from other people who will be calling in a moment. You have one more question?
I do. Excuse me. And it warrants quite a long answer, but maybe you could summarize it. As an economist, it's actually not a male or female. They want to keep anonymous. They've been tracking your projections, and you've been more accurate on all your political and economic projections than anyone else in the media, they're saying. The question is, why aren't the American public putting their minds around the real issues of this country? If Republicans and Democrats are just the co-conspirators and the problems, if you could lay it out right now, what are the problems that America's faced with, and what are the solutions? What are the real problems?
They're not that complicated. The biggest problem is understand figures, and the American public's eyes glaze over when you deal with basic figures. But everything is in the figures. For example, 48% of the Americans are in low income, living near poverty. Now, that's almost half of all Americans. That's about 150 million Americans are in poverty. And there's nothing being done now, nothing that will help them. The only thing that could help them is if you bring jobs back. Now, there's only two ways to bring jobs that are going to be meaningful to them. Either private jobs from small businesses, anywhere from one to a couple hundred employees. And for that, you have to help those small business people get on their feet. My suggestion, offer zero interest loan with no repayment for 2 years. So you have a grace period to get properly financed, get up and get your product or service established. Providing that, you give a living wage and good benefits to those who are employed so they actually have a capacity to save money, get out of debt, and help the economy. Now, if we gave only 10% to the small businesses who qualify, that would be enough to employ 5 million Americans. That means we could get people out of debt. We have 57% of all children in the United States who are living in homes that are low-income or impoverished. The average amount of time that people no longer have jobs is 40 weeks. 77% of all U.S. small businesses are not hiring because they are burdened with all the taxes, generally landlords that are not giving them a break. And they need help. If you help the small businesses, they will continue to hire. If you don't, they can't. Also, the average income for the average home has declined almost 7% in the last few years. and that is not good. Also, you have the reality is that you've had the number of self-employed people who virtually were almost non-existent for about 100 years. Now, in the 1990s, they rose to almost 16 million people were self-employed. And that's terrific. Now they've lost millions because, again, what they offered in the way of services or product are no longer in demand. You also had one out of every five Americans are underemployed, and 20% of all Americans are working at poverty-level wages. And so look at the bad things. The really bad things is the average American, now this is the most important figure I'm going to give you, Elizabeth. The average American's debt to their income is 154%.
Wow.
All right? If you look at a person's household debt, which are not included in any of the government's figures, like the $15 trillion the government owes, that's what the government owes. That's not underfunded or unfunded entitlements. That's $66 trillion. I'm only looking at the over $14 trillion that the average household owes when you cumulatively add them. That means that 154% debt to income, Americans are bankrupt. That's never going to reverse. 64% decline in the value of real estate in California in just one area, Stockton. And 19% of all men between 25 and 34 are now living back with their parents. That used to be zero. So when you look at all this and you see that today we are deeply in debt. And the retirement, there's a whole crisis in retirement out there. The average retired person in the United States, which is 46% of all American workers, they have less than $10,000 in the retirement fund. Nobody can retire on a total of $10,000.
No.
But also 29% of all American workers have under $1,000 in retirement funds. And one out of every six elderly in the United States is in dire poverty. Have you ever heard of any of them? Seen any march for them? Seen anything done for these people?
No.
Nothing.
Nothing.
And yet the big banks are getting bigger. The big corporations are getting bigger. And the money that we do have is in the 65 and older group. But people who are under 35, 37% have zero worth. So how in the world can you have a family, a career? How can you contribute to a society when you have zero net worth?
Yeah.
So that is the sad part. And then the children are the side effect of that. So we need to do two things. And we need to stop allowing the government to be providing 24% of our gross domestic product. We need to encourage independent, self-employed people. We need to include in this the small business people because they could bring us out of this, giving living wages and rejuvenating the economy. We also have to stop all this trade nonsense because we're 5-to-1. For every dollar we receive from China, we give $5 in return in what we buy from them. And that's because we keep outsourcing our labor to China where they can do something cheaper, and then we put someone out of business who then goes to a big box store to buy what they need. We have to start encouraging the reindustrialization of America. And if it means putting in some protection for those jobs and for those companies who are manufacturing, then we should do so. Because I can assure you, Japan did it for years, China's done it, and we chose to go along with it because it was very lucrative for corporations to outsource their factories and what had been American-made products to these companies because they could make massive amounts of profit for their stockholders and their CEOs and boards of directors. But it destroyed tens of millions of working jobs. We have to reverse that. And to reverse that, you have to get politicians in there who are not beholden to the ALEC outsourcing block of companies. And that's who controls the American economy, the banking system today. And the media is on their side, not the small business person, not the self-employed person, not the artist, not the person wanting to move back to the land, all of which could resuscitate America.
That's brilliant. Thank you. I wish the whole media would just cover all those statistics and show the world what's going on.
They won't, because if you told the truth, it would scare people. I realize we're running into the next program. I'm sorry for taking that time. We'll say goodbye to everyone, and I will take some calls on tomorrow's show. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. Our chief archivist is Sharon Price. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.